Even though we are not exactly scientists, sometimes we have findings that are very exciting. And I think that was just so much fun finding this phrase coming up again and again and again in I think almost every writer that this book is about.
Hello, and welcome to another instalment of New Work in Intellectual History, a podcast series produced by the Institute of Intellectual History at University of St. Andrews. Intellectualhistory.net is the website, and if everyone hasn't already left, at St. Andrews IIH on X. And I'm Robin Mills, and I'm your host for this episode. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ilad Karmal, who is a Marie Curie postdoctoral fellow at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland. Hello, Ilad. Ilad, sorry. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you, Robin. It's really good to be here. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Actually, my children were both very grumpy this morning, so I am coming down with some stress levels. And the book we're going to be talking about is Elad's recent Anti-Clerical Legacies, The Deistic Reception of Thomas Hobbes, 1670 to 1740, published in published by Manchester University Press back in spring 2024. So this is a book of reception history. And I think we might need to introduce the second group in the title. Listeners to this podcast will be familiar to Thomas Hobbes, but if you wouldn't mind, could you remind us of who Thomas Hobbes was? And then, perhaps more importantly, who the English deists were and why they might be interesting, please.
Right, thank you. Well, so Hobbes maybe doesn't need much introduction, but of course, one of the greatest political philosophers of all time, some would say. His most famous text was in 1651. That was the Leviathan, arguing for a very powerful sovereign, written in the context of the English Civil War, very much troubled by civil chaos and social conflicts, and looking for a way to put an end to that and establish peace and harmony and happiness that will last hopefully forever. In this sense, Hobbes might even be portrayed as almost a utopian thinker. So to sort of like the idea was to offer a solution that if followed closely, will assure civil peace that will be long-lasting. The English deists and free thinkers are a group. They are very much. It's a question. It's a very interesting question. How to what extent they were actually a unified group? They didn't necessarily see themselves as equal members in that sort of like. Group or identity or label of deism or free thinking, but they did have some personal connections to each other. They did know each other. Most of them did know one another, and to some extent exchanged ideas with one another. And they did pose certain similar challenges to the Anglican clergy. And the ways in which they did that are very interesting. That's part of what the book is about. And there are some commonalities between them, both in what they were trying to do and how they were trying to do that, that allows us to sort of group them into this label of English deism while paying attention to the nuances of who actually talked about deism and what they meant when they did that.
I think I worked on these guys the beginning of my 15 odd years ago, the beginning of my academic career. And I think I joined in at the moment when the category was being pulled apart a bit. So I bet there's a piece that Justin Champion wrote, I think in the early 2000s, where he kind of accepted that back in the early 90s or late 80s, there was a tendency to group them all together. They are one of a tribe, shall we say? And then things were getting a bit, teasing out the differences a bit more complicated. And also, there are a couple of things there. One is the idea that the English deists were created by their opponents.
Right.
That the category is a creation of, this goes back to your sort of last chapter, but William Warburton,
Right.
Leland, and Philip Skelton, and so on. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the creation of deism as a category there. And there are
Perfect.
two other categories. I wonder if you could drop in your introduction. You mentioned the difference between Hobbes and Hobbesianism. Oh, sorry, not Hobbesianism, Hobbism.
Yeah.
There we go. Difference between Hobbes and Hobbism. Could you tell us a bit about that? And then also, you mentioned in your answer just then, you clarified me saying English deists to English deists and three thinkers. I apologize to listeners that I come from the East End of London, and I'm going to say three thinkers as if they both begin with F. I can't stop it. The English deists and the three thinkers. Could you sort of delineate some of those categories for us, please?
Okay, so let me see if I can remember all the questions. First, I want to say about the first thing you said is that this book is very much in honor of the legacy of the work of Justin Champion. I think if there is one scholar that that did such an exemplary work on English anti-clericalism, and discussing the nuances of these thinkers and showing how valuable they were, is it's of course Justin Champion, and the work he did on John Toland in particular, I think had a huge contribution in how we see Toland as a political, philosophical, theological actor, extremely multi-layered and interesting writer. So yeah, so Justin Champion has definitely paved the way for this research, and I have been very lucky to get some feedback from him in earlier stages of writing this book. So yes, so that's just one comment. So I think, of course, it has been quite extensively debated, sort of to what extent they are actually a group. And as you said, the complexities have been raised quite a lot. Part of the complexity, I think, is also related to recent discussions on the Enlightenment. So there was this idea that deism, that's something that Jonathan Israel, for example, has argued prominently, that English deism was part of what he calls radical enlightenment. So something that looks to take away most existing social and theological structures. Then once the Enlightenment itself started to be debated, and to what extent the English Enlightenment was indeed radical, or rather clerical, or something in between, the nature of deism has also been in question again. And what I tried to show in the book is that indeed deism was part of Enlightenment, in English Enlightenment in particular, but then we need to reassess the nature, of course, of that Enlightenment as well. And what I try to show is that the deists, the free thinkers, built what we can call an early anti-clerical enlightenment. So not necessarily as radical as Jonathan Israel would argue. I do not think that they sought to destroy as much of the existing structures of their time. But they were not the clerical enlightenment or conservative enlightenment of Pocock or others either. So they were something in between that I would call anti-clerical enlightenment. But all of these debates, of course, are still ongoing. I think what you mentioned about how this group became a group and the role of the opponents is something that is extremely interesting and that I try to trace in the book, because this is something interesting, I think, about labels in general. And we say that in our society today, who is called what and why and by whom, and what it serves. And you mentioned Hobbes and Hobbism. I think that's exactly the same case. So Hobbes himself became caricatured and used already in his time for multiple purposes by multiple actors. And this is something that, of course, John Parkin has shown already in his Taming the Leviathan, the complex ways in which Hobbes became Hobbism, which meant different things for different groups of readers. What's interesting about deism is, and free thinking is that they both, to a large extent, started as slurs, as terms of abuse or insult. And then what has happened is that there was a very interesting sort of process of appropriation and reappropriation of these terms, both as labels and as identities. And what we see, and this is, of course, it has also to do with the context of how easy it was to publish these kind of views openly. And then towards the early 18th century, when it becomes a bit easier to talk about these things openly, we start seeing these actors, people like Anthony Collins, Matthew Tyndale, Thomas Morgan, calling themselves deists or free thinkers and sort of appropriating these terms, basically saying to their opponents, if you want to call us so and so, that is fine. Let us tell you what we mean by that. And so this is very interesting to see how deism as a term was defined in a dialogue by the opponents of the so-called deists and the deists themselves, who at some point accepted these terms and again did things with these terms. So Thomas Morgan at some point calls himself a Christian deist. Alberto Radicati at some point calls himself a Christian free thinker. So this is part of the story that I'm trying to tell.
Ask about that. So I remember reading on many different occasions the idea that deism as a category, as a label, a pejorative label, was created in the 1740s, 1750s by the enemies of free thinking. But what you're saying there is that actually it is something that is adopted later on, so not later on, earlier, in the midst of controversy, in the midst of debate. In the initial decades of the 18th century. Is that sort of a correction I should be adopting?
I would say so. I would say so. I would say that that the debates on deism start already in the late 1670s, early 1680s, which is also why when Hobbes dies and sort of like exits the stage and leaving it to new writers such as Charles Blount, who is perhaps his most well, his most open pupil in the years following Hobbes' death. And there we already see debates on what deism means. There are the Boyle lectures of the 1690s that take as their goal to refute the atheists and deists and hobbyists of their time. So already putting all of these labels together, I think a really important milestone is the Boyle lecture of Samuel Clarke. So this would be 1704-05, where he not only puts together Hobbes and Spinoza and Toland, but he also defines, and he, in fact, he offers some kind of a typology of what deism means. He offers four types of deists that he identifies. The first type is the one that perhaps I should have said it earlier, is the one that we most commonly associate with deism, which is the idea that it's a belief in a God that does not intervene, that created the world and left it to run by its natural course and natural law, etc. And then again, this is not necessarily a view that was argued for openly, but after Clark, as an opponent of that view, formulates it. So clearly there starts a debate between him and then various actors, including Collins and Tyndale, who in some ways accept this view and develop it further. Then I think what you mentioned is the next step, which we start to see in 1740, 1750s, which sort of these more frequent mentions of all of these names together as some kind of a group, some kind of a tradition of heterodoxy and anti-clericalism, often as some kind of a new historiography of days and by ministers such as John Leland that you mentioned. But what is, if I may just add one more thing, what is very interesting to me has always been to see people like William Warburton, and then later on in the 18th century, like Edmund Burke, sort of claiming, oh, these people are to be ridiculed. These people are to be either laughed at or completely forgotten. But then they still keep mentioning them. So in 1790, you have Edmund Burke arguing, who even reads all of these names? But then he gives the list of all of these names. And then it makes you think, why would you do that? If everybody forgot about them, why remind your readers about them? So there is this really interesting, and then every time something like that happens, we see the days sort of like wake up again, you know, and then after Burke, of course, you have Thomas Paine. So it's a very interesting dialectical process, I think.
Yes, definitely. I think I don't know. I don't want to get this wrong, but I think there's a book to be written about that. I know you've moved on to other things, but the reputation and the legacy of English days and into the second half of the 18th century, I'm sure someone has, and I apologize if you have, dear listener, and I don't know it, but yeah, that kind of what happens next, because this sort of moves into your final chapter, but I need us to go back in a second, but another one of kind of, I don't know whether it's a myth or one of the stories that are told about the history of English deism is it just dies out in the 1740s, 1750s, it just goes away. And like, Henry St. John, Lord Bolingbroke's often seen to be the last, the publication of his philosophical works in 1754 seemed to be the last moment where anything vaguely categorizable as English deism is published. And yeah, it just sort of peters out. And there's a story that's an interesting thing. But let's come back to that at the end if you have more to say. So we talked about that sort of creation of a tradition, that there's an intellectual lineage. That's created by the opponents to some of these ideas and some of these thinkers. And often you have Hobbes as as the father of the lineage. I wondered if you could step back a moment and just sort of talk about the general argument of the book. We've established some of the big themes, but could you sort of yeah, tell us what the book is about and maybe what you were, why you were prompted to write it.
Right. So the book is about all the different ways in which Hobbes and Hobbesian ideas informed this very particular and very interesting challenge to the clergy taken by these writers such as Charles Blount, John Toland, Matthew Tyndale, Anthony Collins, Thomas Morgan, but also others and perhaps even lesser known writers that the book discusses. I think what interested me at first, so my starting point was actually Hobbes. There has been, of course, a lot of debate in the literature on Hobbes' religious beliefs and religious positions. And I think while for many decades we have been, or perhaps even centuries, we've been discussing, you know, whether Hobbes was an atheist or a Christian or something in between, and perhaps this something in between is some kind of a proto-deist. I think the literature in recent decades has started to move on to something slightly more interesting, which is what Hobbes was doing when he was writing about religion, what he was trying to engage with, what audiences he was trying to appeal to, how he sort of took orthodox positions, accepted them, but also subverted them at the same point. Mainly to achieve his political conclusions. So I think, and this is a debate that has been ongoing, and this was kind of my starting point. And then I think at some point, and that's much thanks to John Parkin and his work, I discovered the world of reception studies or reception history. And this is what the book is actually about. And I think Hobbes' reception is so fascinating. First of all, maybe I should say that I think reception in itself is fascinating. It's a fascinating field to see how ideas are just used by different writers for different purposes, whether it's a use of ideas or misuse of ideas. But to see how ideas just develop after the lifetime of the writer who suggested them, and sort of like take like get a life of their own. I think is really interesting, and I think in Holmes' case it's particularly interesting because, as I mentioned, first of all, Hobbes offers such a wide range of ideas and tools. And they were taken by these writers who did so many things with them. And so I think this became the focus of my book, to see how these writers, each in their own way, more or less openly, more or less closely following Hobbes, but taking just different things from Hobbes and doing things with them. While for all of them, there was this very common anti-clerical political goal. And I think in this way, they did build together some kind of an anti-clerical political tradition. So this is what the book is about, and all of the different ways in which Hobbes informed that tradition, not as its exclusive source, but as a very important source.
Fantastic. Yeah, I don't want to get on my soapbox. I think, yeah, I was trained in sort of Cambridge School contextualist history of political thought, where you try and understand the text you're interested in as an intervention in a debate, and you understand the authors, you recover the author's intentions by placing it within that context. Whether the author is successful or not, whether the, I mean, it's bizarre that having to relearn the kind of death of the author argument again and again and again, but you're not in control of what you've written, and it goes out into the world, and people respond to texts in very, very different ways and very complicated ways that might have nothing to do with authorial intention whatsoever. However, so if you only have the authorial intention stuff is one half, and the reception history has to be there as the other half. Anyway, right, off my soapbox. Right, Hobbesian anti-clericalism. Before we get into how he was used, and I apologize for the question, could you give us a pithy summary of some of the key elements of Hobbes's anti-clericalism and where that might be found also textually speaking?
Right. Okay. Every time you comment on an answer, I have more to discuss with you.
You're
That
welcome to do
that's
both.
great. Yeah, Hobbes' anti-clericalism, I think the most obvious place to find it is in the end of Leviathan, in the part that is called the Kingdom of Darkness. So Hobbes is very openly anti-clerical in Leviathan, not only in Leviathan. And of course, Hobbes had his fights with the clergy all along, and at some point became himself a target of atheism and heresy proceedings. In Leviathan, he compares, he argues that what he calls unpleasing priests are the problem of everything that is wrong with religion. And he's quite clear there that it's not just the Catholics he's talking about. So it's of course it builds on an anti-Catholic sentiment, but it's not only that. And in the Kingdom of Darkness, he compares the ecclesiastics to fairies who, you know, go about in their dark corridors and turn the laity into what he calls natural fools. And I think there it's the harshest at times funniest part of Leviathan that also I think explains to us why Hobbes is doing what he's doing, why he what kind of philosophy he is trying to structure, of course in response to this scholastic philosophy that is so full of errors for him that he tries to correct. And the ecclesiastics are a major part of maintaining these errors. in order to gain power. So and there we see very clearly the idea that that they try to use what he calls charms and false metaphysics and abused scriptures to maintain blind obedience to them. And what Hobbes is writing against is what he calls in Leviathan the problem of seeing double. So the worst thing for Hobbes is that is when sovereignty is not unified, because this is where social or civil wars and chaos starts, which is what he sees at his time. So of course his idea is that the civil sovereign is the sovereign, full stop. And it is when the clergy or when the church seeks to gain independent political power is that when we start seeing the problems arise. And so the problem that he calls seeing double is when a subject is confused whether they should obey the civil sovereign or the church, whether it's the Pope or etc. So it's against that that he's doing what he's doing, and trying to uncover the mistakes that he attributes both to scholastics and ecclesiastics, and sort of like uncovering the ecclesiastics as this kingdom of darkness. So I think this is a major focus of Hobbes' anticlericalism. Of course, there are other things we can discuss later, other tools that he's offering that are maybe a bit more subtle. Of course, one of them, maybe I should say that as well, is his argument early in Leviathan that he tries to then explain and clarify and partly take back, partly not, that there is no such thing as incorporeal substances. So this is part of course, his materialism. It's also part of trying to correct all of these false and obscure notions. And so the conclusion for him is complete materialism. So matter is matter. Every substance is by definition corporeal, is a body. Then of course what it means for God, which is another huge debate that Hobbes becomes part of and that our deists and free thinkers follow in interesting ways. So this is maybe just a couple of examples of Hobbes' anti-clericalism and suspected heterodoxies.
Fantastic. I love the Kingdom of Darkness. It's such a great,
I
I mean,
agree.
Dmitri Levitin got that for the book title, right? But it's such a great phrase. So let's jump in then. Let's see if we can tie some of what you just said into. So there were four chronologically arranged chapters in the book. Let's jump into sort of deism emerges kind of in the undergrowth a little bit in like the 1670s, 1680s. Could we say something about what's going on there and how Hobbes's work informs, I mean, the focus on that in that first chapter is on reason and natural religion and toleration, I think. So yeah, when you mention some of these names, we've talked about Blount and Tyndale and Toland and so on. Could you give us very very short biographies of them? A couple of very just a little bit of detail about who they are. But yes, what's going on in the 1670s, please?
Okay, thank you. We're talking, I think, about the early weeks. And here I should also acknowledge, of course, the work of Mark Goldie, who I think was the first to suggest that Hobbes was a as counterintuitive as it might sound, Hobbes was an interesting source also for Whiggish political views. And so the actors that I write about in these years in the late 1670s are mainly Charles Blount and a lesser known writer, but equally important, Albertus Warren. And they moved in these Whiggish circles of the time. A major debate, political debate, was about the exclusion of the Duke of York in order to not have a Catholic king, and a move that, of course, failed. And so we see, and the interesting thing, and there are in this since the early 1670s, we see Warren and others such as Martin Clifford writing about natural reason and of course debates on religious toleration that start already earlier. My focus there is about how we start seeing these writings about natural religion being associated with deism. This is something that happens openly in the 1680s. Again, thanks to John Dryden, who writes against it, which prompts Charles Blount to write in favor. But also, already before that, we see
But the
Warren
same
and.
book title, right?
Sorry?
He Blount names his book the same title
Exactly,
as Dryden's, yeah.
exactly, 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 exactly. So that's 1682, 83. But even before that, we see Blount and Warren starting to write a. In favor of naturalism being the main focus of religion, basically discrediting the need of for everything for anything that is not based on naturalism in religion. Of course, the main controversy here is what does it mean about revelation and whether it becomes completely redundant. And both Warren and Blount are very much Hobbesian. In many different ways. And what's interesting is that they are the only ones that I discuss in the book that overlap with Hobbes' lifetime and that actually have some contact with Hobbes. So one very interesting example. So yeah, you asked about biographies. So Blount, he writes a letter to Hobbes where he says, "Oh, I read your manuscript on heresy," which is what then was published. As the historical narration of heresy, where Hobbes says, well, let's see what heresy actually means. Originally, it just meant a private opinion. Then, of course, starting to question who makes a heresy and why. And Blount takes this very interesting and subtle theme of tracing the political earthly influences on religion. And he attributes it to Hobbes openly. And so he what Hobbes what Blount does in his letter to Hobbes is to quote a line from Hobbes to paraphrase it, which is when reason is against a man will be against reason. And he says, you yourself observe that so well. And from there he goes to say, well, then we just need to question the political interests of all of the fathers of the church, the big councils of Christianity who made decisions about what a heresy is and what is not, what is included in the canon and what is not. And this starts a huge, I think, period in which Anthony Collins and others play a very important role later, and Toland, of course, of examining everything. So why did the council decide what they decided? Did they forge documents? Did they not? Etc. And it all starts with this notion of the politics of religion that I think Blount and Warren take from Hobbes very clearly and very well, I think.
I ask about that phrase. When reason is against a man will be against reason. Well, that's not, is that, I don't know if that's precise wording. That appears regularly in the book,
Exactly, yeah.
and it becomes a sort of a slogan.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about its afterlife?
Yeah. So I think so even though we are not exactly scientists, sometimes we have findings that are very exciting. And I think that was and I think that was just so much fun finding this phrase coming up again and again and again in I think almost every writer that this book is about. And then, of course, this is an interesting question about reception methods. I mean, of course, at some point you don't know anymore where they take it from, whether they take it from one another, it just become a catchphrase. But this is such an interesting term to take, and especially today when we live in well, the age of post-truth, and people taking people being flexible with what truth is and what reason is, and depending on whether reason shows the desirable conclusions for them or not. But this is something that so Blount attributes to actually as John Parkin has shown it is used in Parliament in 1668 in the debates on toleration. But then Blount takes it and then it appears yeah and until at least the 1720s or 1730s, actually. It appears in the Independent Whig. It appears then in Matthew Tyndale's Christianity as Old as the Creation. But I think what is very interesting is that it became such an important sort of like anti-clerical phrase that even the clerical opponents of these writers also started using that, but they changed it to when religion is against a man will be against religion. So basically, they told the deists and free thinkers, well, you're doing the same thing. You're just writing against religion because you don't like what religion tells you to do. So that was very interesting to see how they engaged with that phrase to contradict the free thinkers.
Yeah, reception history is great for you, sort of, or studying controversies is great because you see like the changes in arguments stage by stage. You've done that, I counterpunch. You punch, I counterpunch. You've
Exactly.
done that, it's a very rich way of doing things. What I find interesting about that phrase is that it goes against, so one of the things you might find maybe in the older literature is that the English deists and free thinkers were believed in the power of reason. The reason's ability to explain everything. You go against the irrationality of revealed religion. You can criticize the abuse of religion by priestcraft and so on, and you would expose that using the power of reason. But that the phrase there, if reason is against a man will be against reason, is something. It's a very different message. Is there any, could you go any further with that? Is there are the yeah? What's the position of reason in the work of, I mean, this is 70, 80 years you're covering, but is that a naive, an older, naive understanding about the status of reason in the English deist moment?
You're right. I think, well, first of all, seeing that it is coming from Hobbes, I think, and Hobbes held a much more complex notion of human reason and in some ways perhaps portrayed it as slightly more limited than what the deists would say or more proper Enlightenment thinkers would say. And the main point is about so the power of reason. Yes, very much. I think for the deists is a central point. And I think for Hobbes and for the deists as well is about the manipulation of reasons. So there is this notion of be wary of what the clergy tells you about reason. For the deists, what the deists do with that mainly is to contrast the scheme of what they call reason and liberty or liberty of thought with what they call the scheme of authority. So do not follow the authority of priests because the priests just tell you to think what serves their own interests. And so use your own reason and freedom of thought.
I want to possibly jump forward to the next chapter, which focuses on the deist controversy, which is about 1696 to 1710. Something happens in 1696, you can tell us about that. And then, and what's Hobbes's role in, because this is a continuation of, I think, with the debates over reason, right? What the deist controversy. So, could you flesh that out a little bit for us? Thank you.
Right. So 1693, Charles Blount's Oracles of Reason has been published, including that letter to Hobbes that I mentioned. And already in the late 1690s, we see a lot of alarm. I mentioned the Boyle lectures that start 1692 with people like Richard Bentley and others who already write against atheism, deism, Hobbism, Spinozism, and all of these things together.
I just said, can I interrupt there? Can I ask? You will find the argument often that those labels are not clearly. You've spoke about this a bit already, I know, but that those labels aren't clearly delineated. Atheist and deist are the same thing to a lot of people, and Socinian and whatever. They're all overlapping, and they're just terms of abuse that you throw at someone. Is this sort of the moment where? You have answered this already, haven't you? Is there some truth to that, or do you think there's actually clear delineation going on already by the 1690s? And also, this is a really nerdy niche one. Sorry, dear listener. The difference between deist and theist, because you mentioned William Nichols's book, The Conference with the Theist, which is, I think, it's one of these sort of books that is actually really, really important in the history of 17th, 18th century intellectual English intellectual history. But he uses very specifically theist, and I just want, are these terms clearly understood? Is that happening at the moment? And what's the difference between deists and theists?
I think at this point they're still quite all confused together. With the clerical writers kind of trying to uncover these alternative labels, saying basically they all lead straight to atheism. So deism might be a nicer name, you know, because Deus, and it sounds like slightly more divine, such as theism. But in fact, if you follow their own premises, then it just leads to atheism. So the and in those years, we will get to talk about John Toland and his Christianity Not Mysterious in 1696. It is not a book that argues openly to being deist or deistic. I think the first very important delineation is what I mentioned that happens in 1704 and 5 with Samuel Clarke. I think that is the first attempt to actually offer this kind of typology of deistic positions. I think until then we see these terms being used more and more. And part of what I do in the book, in the earlier parts of the book, is to see to just see how this term appeared even before the 1670s. It appeared very rarely, but it did in English texts before. It appears in Bayle's dictionary. So, but I think in the 1690s, it's still a very messy territory. Of course, Locke is also being thrown into or throwing himself into this mess, while also being called a deist, but also writing against deism, etc. So, in this the 1690s, I think the deist controversy is still very much the terms are still not very well delineated, I would say.
Okay, so let's jump in. Thank you. Let's jump into John Toland's Christianity Not Mysterious, a book usually seen as a Lockean text, pushing John Locke on reason further than he was willing to go himself. But you see the Hobbesian elements here. Could you very briefly outline what Christianity Not Mysterious is about, and then what how Hobbes is used by Toland, please?
Christianity Not Mysterious is a great book. I think it's and one of the books that you know that tell you everything in their title, right? So that there is no such mystery. There's no such thing as mystery in religion and etc. And what seems mysterious in religion is something that has been made seem really mysterious again for reasons of priestcraft. We talked about priestcraft. We actually didn't, I think, define that term, but it's another really interesting term that comes up by all of these writers, sort of like priestcraft, the corrupt tactics of the power-hungry clergy to make the laity ignorant and blindly obedient to the church. And of course, Justin Champion, who we have mentioned, has shown how a lot of these writers wrote a sort of like alternative historiography of priestcraft, so how Christianity was or had been corrupted, again with some Hobbesian ideas of vain philosophy and etc. And John Toland does that, basically arguing Christianity had been easy and simple and clear. It should be again once we take out all of these priestcraft and its erroneous influences. And as you mentioned, it has been rightly described as book with connections to Locke as well as Spinoza. And Toland, we maybe we should say that as well, is a very eclectic and very interesting and writer with multiple influences. He's been of course, he's a very important actor in the Republican scene, with influences from Harrington and others. We also see the influences of John Milton on a lot of these writers, and I focus on the Hobbesian, angle of the story, as you mentioned. And it's interesting to see that. So there is a lot of this sort of like Kingdom of Darkness vibe going on in Christianity Not Mysterious, but Hobbes is not credited there openly, which again raises the challenge of reception history, but we do see John Toland crediting Hobbes in other writings of his from the same time. And so he has an anonymous text attributed to him from 1695, which is a year before Christianity Not Mysterious, in which he says openly, "I would now go into talking about demons and demonology, but in fact I don't need to do that because Hobbes is already doing that in the Kingdom of Darkness." Another thing that Toland does in these years is to engage with Hobbesian both materialism and biblical criticism, and showing how these two combined are very powerful anti-clerical tools. We can maybe elaborate on that later, but this is something that he develops in a Hobbesian way and pushing it much more forward, both by giving Hobbesian arguments and examples and developing what we can call Hobbesian tools of materialism and biblical criticism.
Okay. Can we do a bit more perhaps about the deist controversy in the succeeding decades? So that book comes out in 1696. What's going on the next 15 odd years, and what role might Hobbesian ideas play in that? And then can we sort of begin to link that into this idea of free thinking, there we go, turns up in the 1710s as something new. Is it new? Is it an outgrowth? Is it where does it come from? So yeah, can we seep in from your, what's that? That's your second into your third chapters, please.
Right, okay. So maybe to answer the first half of the question, so yeah, we do see, especially I think John Toland starting to do all of his investigations into history of religion and history of priestcraft. He develops his materialism, which he arrives at in 1704 in his letters to Serena on with his theory of active matter, which again can be interpreted, although this is a bit more speculative, as a development of a Hobbesian position, so the position that not only is everything matter and a plenum basically, but also that the matter can move itself, and if that is the case, then of course the clerical opponents would say that maybe that it takes God's role out of the picture, and then we see part of the reaction to that is Samuel Clarke and his argument that Toland just continues what Hobbes and Spinoza had started, and again that it's kind of deism that is in fact covered atheism. Following that, we have Anthony Collins starting an intense, very interesting, very sophisticated, I would say, philosophical and theological correspondence with Samuel Clarke. And this is also when Anthony Collins starts to maybe to take the center stage. And I think that will lead us. And then, of course, in 1706, we have Matthew Tyndale writing on the right of the rights of the Christian of the church. Also, a book that argues that there cannot be two powers in society. So basically, again, that the civil sovereign should control the church, whatever that means. So we have Tyndale taking Tyndale coming forward, and we have Collins. And I think Tyndale and Collins are also the major actors of the following decade, which is, as you mentioned, so the 1710s, very much the decade of the free thinking controversy. So if we had the 1690s, the deist controversy, we now have the free thinking controversy. But the free thinking controversy is in a way a natural development of the deist controversy, because if the deist controversy was about the importance of natural reason and natural religion as opposed to revealed religion, Now there sort of comes the more political or philosophical implication of that, which is that we all have a reason, and so we all should have the freedom to use it. And as Anthony Collins says in 1713, The Discourse of Free Thinking, we all have the right and the duty to know the truth and to use our reason to discover it. And so what Anthony Collins is doing is writing in 1713 a discourse on the occasion of what he calls the rise and growth of a sect called free thinker. So we have a notion that something of like that has been talked about or discussed, again, most probably as a term of abuse. And we have Shaftesbury writing about free thinking already a couple of years before that. And this idea that our thought, should be limited only by our own thoughts, basically. And then what Collins does is to formulate some kind of a manifesto of free thinking. Again, very much anti-clerical, very much opposing the priests telling us what to think because they have their own interests. And one of the things he does there is to build a canon of free thinkers of old time, including ancient characters such as Seneca and Plato and Cicero, getting to modern times with three names, Bacon, Tillotson, and Hobbes. And this is such an interesting puzzle.
Tillotson and Hobbes.
Yeah, exactly. So Tillotson himself was used by these free thinkers as well. As sort of like the liberal clergyman who thought that people should use their own reason in religious matters. But then why is Hobbes there? And maybe more specifically, why is Hobbes there and not Locke or Milton or Spinoza? And this is very interesting again as an exercise of reception to see how Hobbes is constructed as a free thinker and what for. And part of the reasons that Collins gives is that, well, he writes in a very witty way or in a very clear way, or so it's not only about what Hobbes is saying, but is how he's saying that. But then another thing that he says is that Hobbes was fighting the clergy. Hobbes was fighting the clergy be because the clergy was fighting Hobbes. So he gives Collins gives an example there of an instance where in Wood's History of Oxford there was an attempt to replace something that was written in favor of Hobbes into something that was not so flattering to Hobbes, and that attempt was by the Oxford clergy. And then Collins goes into that story about Hobbes was trying to fight against that. But I think it's this sort of like this anti-clerical identity that he attributes to Holmes that makes him that paves the way into including him in the canon of the greatest free thinkers of all time.
It's interesting because you wouldn't, they wouldn't have used the Enlightenment or enlightened. I don't think that wouldn't have been their word, but it does position Hobbes as a hero of the Enlightenment. He is a hero. He is someone to imitate and be inspired by,
Yeah,
and the reason
absolutely.
why he is being imitated is because he was fighting the good fight against priestcraft. And he
Yeah,
provided you
exactly.
with the ideas and the tools to fight back against priestcraft. And the battle against priestcraft is the battle against religious conflict more generally.
Exactly.
On one level, it's about these people shouldn't have the power that they have, but it's also about we have been in conflict. It's, I don't think I'm too far there. Let me know if you think I'm going too far there. But well, as you were when you were talking earlier on, I sort of just made the note that this is the English deists and free thinkers are doing the radical end of the English Enlightenment. They're doing the work of the Enlightenment. If the Enlightenment is understood as trying to come up with solutions to not have the 30 Years' War again, it's one of the versions of the Enlightenment, then they are this is their version. Their version is to go after manipulative priests and dethrone them, not dethrone them, I suppose is the right way. You could say it like that. Take their authority away. And then who do you turn to? Who can you be inspired by? It's Hobbes. It's really, I really, yeah, it was a very interesting discussion in that chapter. Is there anything else we could say about free thinking and Hobbes's role in that? Or can we, anything you wanted to say in response to what I just said before we then move into, well, I think it's your last chapter is very interesting because it goes into the stuff that's usually skimmed over. I know, like Wayne Hudson and so on, the people that have been people who've been trying to write the history of deism in the 1730s and 1740s, but it's still sort of seen as the fun bit, the exciting bit, is Toland and Tyndall and Collins, right? But there's stuff going on. So I apologize for my practice of throwing three questions at you at once. But yeah, can we say anything more about free thinking? Could we move into the next chapter and what's exciting about the 1730s and 1740s, please?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. No, so I will then apologize for maybe not answering any of these questions, but just
Fair
saying
enough.
what comes into my mind. I think, yeah, so I think maybe one more thing to say is that Collins, like Toland, and I think this is something that I really try to show, kind of similar to what Justin Champion did with Toland. One thing that I do try to do in the book and also in a separate article that I published is to show how much how interesting Collins is, and how also multi-layered and sophisticated and nuanced he is, and so. He's best known for writing this Free Thinking Manifesto, but in fact he's doing a lot of other things that are equally interesting. And maybe I'll just give a couple of examples, because I think what you said, it was such a good summary about Hobbes as the Enlightenment, this proto-Enlightenment figure. It's really interesting to see that it's not just that they take from him. And one more thing that I found, again, not a scientist, but sometimes findings are exciting. There is a letter that Anthony Collins sends to a friend of his, and he says there, and this is during that time that he develops this the Hobbesian theory of liberty and necessity, and corresponding with Samuel Clarke, and he says, well, I just read, sorry, I just read De Corpore concerning body of Hobbes, and because there is a specific paragraph in one of the chapter 25 of De Corpore that everybody is discussing at this time, and he says, I was amazed to see that Mr. Clarke is misrepresenting what Hobbes says there. And then he says, well, but actually, I could see that a lot of Hobbes' adversaries are doing exactly that. So either Mr. Clarke is not reading him well, or he's taking Hobbesian, so-called Hobbesian positions from what Hobbes' adversaries are attributing to Hobbes. And this is so very interesting, I think, to see Collins not only taking Hobbes' side, and not only doing that on not just as on anti-clericalism, generally, but on a very specific idea and text, but also already reflecting on this process of reception. So basically, what Collins is talking there is about Hobbes and Hobbism, basically saying Hobbes is not the same as Hobbism, and if we discuss Hobbes, if we take ideas from Hobbes, let's make sure that we read him well. So Collins, this is one thing that Collins does. Then in the 1720s, Collins is doing a lot of work on again, history of Christianity, arriving at very controversial conclusions there. But then he's also involved in some political, and this is also something that is very interesting with Collins, because every time he makes a controversial, or somebody actually makes a controversial and arguably heterodox argument, then somebody attacks them for not having the right to publish such heterodox views. And then Collins starts a more philosophical or political debate about the right of freedom of thought, and also freedom of debate and expression. And then we see one thing that I do in the last chapter is to show Collins' later works that are not often discussed in the literature, where he, I think, gets into a much more nuanced political conclusion, which is that in the end, Again, the best way of taking power from political power or independent political power from the church is giving it to the civil sovereign. And in the end, we have to admit that the civil sovereign has what Collins calls the liberty of conscience to decide what is right and what is not. And Collins says, well, the civil sovereign should be guided by the law of nature, but the civil sovereign is the one who, in the end, will decide what is included in the law of nature. And sure, we can write discourses such as Collins' discourses to advise them to, you know, enact to, religious toleration and etc. But in the end, it is the civil sovereign who has the right to decide. And so, in this sense, he seems to arrive at an almost Hobbesian position. So the sort of like the idea of taking away the authority of the clergy, resulting in giving quite a lot of power to the civil sovereign. So this is one thing that is happening in the last chapter of the book. And then another thing, as you mentioned, is to discuss more in depth some of the writers who, as you mentioned, are sometimes skipped in the historiography of Judaism or not as well discussed. Although, as you mentioned, also there is some good literature on them. One of them is Thomas Morgan, who is an extremely interesting writer who he's so anti-clerical that at some point he calls himself an anti-churchist, or he says, this is my anti-churchism. But he's someone who starts as a minister, then gets into some arguments with fellow ministers, and then developing what he calls his Christian deism, which is a bit more complicated, has views that are quite problematic in terms of his notions of ancient Judaism, etc. But he, in the end, writes in the late 1730s, the Moral Philosopher, which then William Warburton finds so alarming. The book ends with this debate between Morgan and Warburton, where Warburton, as you mentioned, lists this lineage of heterodoxy from Hobbes to Morgan, until in 1742, when Morgan dies. William Warburton just writes to a friend of his, I'm just so happy now that the redoubtable Dr. Morgan is dead. So
Oh, he's charming, Warburton.
exactly. And you have been working on Warburton, haven't you?
To be en entering into his correspondence is to enter into a mental world that is not very pleasant. It's very competitive, very aggressive. It does not surprise me that he was happy that his enemies had died. Yes. So, is there anything else that we can say about deism in the 1730s, 1740s? Or you can take that as your last question, or you can tell us about what you're moving on to next. Because I, before we started recording, you mentioned that you've abandoned this world and you've moved into the world of feminist utopian thinking during the 18th century. Is that
No,
right? Oh, no, sorry. I wasn't listening, honest.
no, I'm kidding. It is true. The only thing that is not right is that I abandoned that world.
Okay, no.
No, it is true. So I think it in the I think we covered the 1730s, 40s quite well. I think we also see maybe one more thing that is interesting to say is that we see this lineage, this heterodox lineage, being named not only by the opponents but also by by some followers. And Alberto Radicati is a really interesting character. He's an Italian guy who comes to London, and he writes also against priestcraft, etc. And he the history of priesthood, and he at some point names all of these writers that we mentioned. We didn't speak much actually about the Independent Whig and Cato's Letters, but they're also in the mix. And he names them as you know, and their specific works as sort of like doing this fantastic work of free thinking. And it's also interesting to see the reflections of someone like Radicati saying, Well, Hobbes and Spinoza had started that, but they had to write more carefully. Then people like Toland and Collins and Gordon and Trenchard came and did things more openly and radically and explicitly. But there is this assumption that they are the ones who got Hobbes and Spinoza right, or they are the ones who really got what Hobbes and Spinoza were trying to do, which then again brings us back to the question of reception and the relation between the reception and the original sort of like meaning of these writers. But there is at least this notion that they were in many ways the most immediate and the most diligent followers of Hobbes, who also present us with the most sympathetic or the most positive reception of Hobbes in the late 17th and early 18th century, where Hobbes was infamous for so many things, and Hobbism in particular was not a good thing and not a good label. And Hobbes Hobbism was the lack of natural sociability, and it was egoism, it was atheism, it was many things, de factoism, etc. But then the deists and free thinkers show us what a positive reception of Hobbes can look like. And I think then seeing someone like Radicati identifies that process is particularly interesting. And then maybe one more word. So the book actually ends, and this is something that we actually started with. So the conclusion of the book is saying, well, yes, in many ways, 1740s is a good place to is a good, point to stop this part, this episode or this chapter of the story. But in fact, the story doesn't end. And we see it, well, we see it in the second half of the 18th century with people like Bolingbroke that you have mentioned. And then in the 1790s, there is some kind of a reawakening. I mentioned Burke and Paine. And then the conclusion just shows a few more examples into the 19th century, both in England and in America. And of course, we need to say that it's not limited to these countries as well. So we do have futures of these stories in Germany and Scotland and other countries as well. But I show just a couple of examples from 19th century England and America of the development of these ideas, the development of deism, and the ways in which these writers are still grouped together, and not only by opponents, and not even by these famous followers, but even by anonymous writers who write letters to American newspapers saying, well, we read all these writers from Hobbes and to Paine, and now I'm a deist. There is a future to this story, more than one future maybe to be told. I did move to work on feminism and utopianism, but I think it's very much related still. So one of my questions is how later notions of free thought and free thinking informed both early feminist and anti-slavery arguments. And I look in particular in the 1790s on writers like Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Hayes, who employed in some ways notion of free thinking and of priestcraft to argue for the right of men and women to use reason and against, so whereas someone like Collins argued against the tyranny of the clergy over the minds of men, then now we have these writers writing against wider structures of tyranny over the minds of men and women. So I do also look into these connections and these kind of futures of the story.
Fantastic. I look forward to having you guys, having you back on when the fruits of that are published. So the book is Eliot Carmel's Anti-Clerical Legacies, The Deistic Reception of Thomas Hobbes, circa 1670 to 1740, published by Manchester University Press, in hardback at the moment, hopefully a paperback out in a couple of years. Get your libraries to buy it by yourself if you're very well-moneyed. But no, it's really fantastic. It works really well. Sorry to hog the last bit. It works really well as a history of English deism as well as a reception history. It sort of delineates the various stages to deism. So I enjoyed it on that level as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And see you, dear listener, very soon. Bye.
Thank you.